Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Today, we are joined by Rabbi Avi Hoffman, and we are going to be exploring a tshuva of the Ravid about murder under the influence of alcohol. It's very dark and unfortunately a very relevant topic. And we're going to deal with this going several hundred years back. So that way we can keep things a little bit more abstract, though certainly we're going to keep in mind the practical implications of it as well as we discuss it. Rabbi Avi Hoffman is the assistant rabbi at Congregation Or Torah in West Orange, as well as an executive OUJLIC fellow at Columbia University. He is completing a master's in medieval Jewish history at Revel. Ah, I see, the medieval, this is where it comes in. And a certificate in pastoral counseling at Furkoff. He is also a passionate magician and recently completed a relief mission performing tour with Magicians United for Israel. We'll have to have you back on another time to tell us about that experience. Rabbi Hoffman, it's wonderful to have you on. And I was thinking, first of all, shkayach, that we are going to lean into your expertise in medieval Jewish history and looking at a tshuva of the Ravid, though I think one of the important things to probably clarify for myself, and I'm sure the listeners would appreciate, is that I'm pretty certain there was a number of Ravids floating around. Mm-hmm. So maybe you want to tell us which Ravid we're actually looking at, who he was, put him in context of the other Ravids, general background for the tshuva. And I understand you're also going to go a little further back in history than medieval times and tell us about the drinking culture of ancient Persia as well. All of this is, of course, very much on theme as we are recording shortly before Purim.
Yes, thank you very much, Rabbi Kurtz. It's a pleasure to see you. And we haven't had a lot of time to talk since we were together in the Rav J.J. Chabura in Smicha together.
Ah.
And I think I was there in your last year. We overlapped very briefly, and I'm
passing
still a member.
Passing ships in the night, yes.
Passing ships in the night, 100%. And it's just a pleasure to talk to you, and I'm very excited to delve into the topic we have today. So first thing you mentioned is that there are multiple Ravids, which is true. There are at least three, and they all lived very close to each other. And if you look through the literature, it's often not specified which Ravid they're talking about. So you have to really know who they're discussing. There's obviously the famous one, but he's the third Ravid. There are two Ravids that precede him, but it's kind of strange in that way. So Ravid,
the famous one, I assume you mean the Ravid on the Rambam? You're
the Ravid on the Rambam, that's Avraham ben David of Paskier. He's known as HaRavid HaShlishi. And he lived from 1125 to 1198. He's most famous for his glosses on the Mishneh Torah, but he had many other things that were probably more important to him specifically. But that's what he became known for, is a very confrontational and argumentative and very passionate arguer for his positions. But there are two before him. So the Ravid HaRishon, who we're not going to be discussing today, is Abraham ibn Daud, who lived from 1110 to 1180. He's the author of the Sefer HaKabbalah, which is very fiercely attacking the Karaites of his time. And the Ravid Hasheni, who we will be discussing today, the second Ravid, is Abraham ben Yitzchak of Narvon. And he lived from 1080 to 1158. So we have this weird situation where the second Ravid actually lived before the first Ravid. However, the second Ravid is the father-in-law of the third Ravid. I know, it's a bit complicated. So
my head's starting to spin. Got to pull out the Art Scroll Masifta Yevamos charts, right?
There are two Ravids that are most important to us, the famous Ravid on the Rambam and his father-in-law. Now, the father-in-law does not have a Dalet in his name, so why is he called the Ravid? Where does the duh come from at the end of that? The answer is because he was the Av Beis Din. So Ravid in that case means Rav Av Beis Din. So Rav Avraham ben Yitzchak of Narvon is the one who we're going to be focusing on. He is the father-in-law, again, of the famous Ravid, and the one who wrote the classic text on the Ravid on the Rambam was Isidore Twersky. I have his biography right here. Father of Rav Meir Twersky and Rav Moshe Twersky, Hashem Yikom Demo. And in the biography of the Ravid, he talks about his father-in-law. And he writes about him that, you know, this Ravid is also known as the Ravi, which really is what his name stands for, Rav Avraham ben Yitzchak, which is special for me because when I was a rabbi up in Scout Camp and in Aria Adventures, as you were also, the kids were a little bit hesitant to call me Rabbi Hoffman. It seemed a bit too impersonal, and also didn't want to call me Avi. It seemed too familiar. So they compromised and they called me Ravi. So we kind of share this title, and that's really the only similarity I have with the hero of our story today.
So you know, it's like sometimes when people, you know, they don't call me Rabbi Kurtz, they say Rav Moshe. I'm like, well, you know, I guess if you're putting me in the same boat as Rav Moshe Feinstein, I'm not going to complain. He gets called Rav Moshe also. Who am I to complain about that?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. That's I actually got that one, I think, from Rabbi Ezra Cohen, a colleague of ours. And I think his Rebbetzin came up with that idea of just responding like that. But anyway, so this is fascinating. So there's three different Ravids. Two of them are related. We're looking at the father-in-law of the one on the Rambam. Mm-hmm. And maybe before we even jump into his tshuva, I think there was some even just broader historical background about alcohol and drinking culture before this tshuva was even written. And then we'll jump into it. How about that?
Sure. So as we know, the Megillah mentions alcohol explicitly. And I want to read from a couple psukim. This is from Esther chapter 1, pasuk 10 to 15 is really where I want to focus on. It talks about how on the seventh day of Achashverosh's party, Ketov, Lev HaMelech B'Yayin, the king was very happy with wine, and he calls Mehuman and Bizasa and his other servants or other officers and tells them to bring Vashti wearing the royal crown, and Vashti refuses to come. And immediately after that, Vayomar HaMelech L'Chachamim Yodei Ha'itim, that the king tells to his wise people, to his scholars, the ones who knew the time, some legal counselors, he tells them what happened, and he calls the seven other people to see what they should do with the Queen Vashti. And he wants to take this legal counsel while he's drunk. And one problem that's presented to all of the Mefarshim on these Pesukim is why in the world would Achashverosh seek legal counsel while he's drunk? And the Midrashim, the Gemara, and the Mefarshim seem to paint Achashverosh as either very wicked or as a very foolish person. And I want to offer an alternative way of reading this. This is from, I'm going to read from a historian, an ancient historian. His name is Herodotus, who was a Greek historian. He actually lived at the time of the Purim story. If we place it in the CE and BCE years, he is contemporary. He's actually born around the same time. So he's no more than 50 or 100 years away from the Purim story. He may actually be living at the same time.
By the way, I appreciate that because many times I just find my own education when I study Jewish history and I study world history, they are bifurcated as two separate areas. And just like, oh, I remember reading about Herodotus in my literature class and history class, and I never even thought to kind of line him up with the Purim story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm going to present one example from Herodotus that sheds massive light into the Megillah, but there are five or six others that I can share with you offline, and maybe you find ways of publicizing these yourself. It really opens up the Megillah in very fascinating ways. So Herodotus, when he's talking about the Persians, he's either talking about Achashverosh and his kingdom itself, or people who lived right around the same time, within a few decades, literally. So what he writes about the Persians is that they are very partial to wine, and it is their custom to deliberate upon the gravest matters when they're drunk. And what they approve in their deliberations is proposed to them the next day when they are sober. And if, being sober, they still approve it, they act on it. But if not, they drop it. And if they deliberated about a matter when sober, then they decide upon it when they're drunk. So that's me reading from Herodotus. It's a very strange custom that the Persians have this minhag of talking about the law and talking about the most important issues when they are drunk. Why in the world, why in the world would they have this very strange custom? So about 500 years later, there's another historian named Tacitus, and he's living at the time of Churban Bayis Sheni. And he's also talking about the Persians, and he explains this this custom. And he's talking about the Persians as well. And he writes that to pass an entire day and night in drinking disgraces no one. Persians drink a lot. They're very known for their intoxication. And he writes that their quarrels, as might be expected with intoxicated people, are seldom fought out with mere abuse, but commonly with wounds and bloodshed. So they really fight and they kill each other, literally while they're drunk, which will be relevant to our tshuva later, as we'll see. And he says, yet it is at their feasts that they generally consult on the reconciliation of enemies, on the forming of matrimonial alliances, on the choice of chiefs, finally even on peace and war. for they think that at no time is the mind more open to simplicity of purpose or more warmed to noble aspirations. A race without either natural or acquired cunning, they disclose their hidden thoughts in the freedom of the festivity. Thus, the sentiments of all having been discovered and laid bare, the discussion is renewed on the following day, and from each occasion its own peculiar advantage is derived. They deliberate when they have no power to dissemble. They resolve when error is impossible. Put in layman's terms, what this means is that they feel that if they have two conversations about anything, one while drunk and one while sober, the advantage is that while they're drunk, no one will hide their private thoughts. Nichnas yayin yatsa sod. When wine comes in, everyone is going to spill exactly what they're thinking. Then they can have a conversation again while sober, when they all are in their right minds again, but this time they can converse about all the facts in front of them. And in that way, they can make the best possible decisions. So when we read the Megillah and we see Ahasuerus taking legal counsel while drunk, we paint him as a fool and someone who's doing something that's way beyond the pale and something that we can't understand. But if we read it through the lens of Herodotus and Tacitus, we see that what he's doing is actually very much in line with these ancient Persian customs and the way they deliberated on the most grave of their matters.
Wow. And this is like a real, as our Rebbe, Rabbi J.J. Schachter would say, L'kayim ashenem ar toru umada, but not in the perfunctory sense. This is very enlightening. Shkoyach. And what's interesting also is that many times I think kind of we approach the issue of wine almost anachronistically. We understand today the challenges of alcohol addiction a little bit better perhaps than they did in previous years, with mental health and those fields growing. And we look at especially those Rishonim who codified the mitzvah to actually get inebriated, like why would they do something like that? And again, it still raises pretty good questions, but then you put it in its broader historical context, and you had even the Persians who said that there's a maila, that there's an advantage to being inebriated and removing those inhibitions to even rendering decisions or, you know, it's a remarkable thing to really put it in that historical context. So that's yes. During the times of what we're talking, the Purim story and Bais Sheni, and now we fast forward to the tshuva of the Ravid with that understanding. I believe the case in the tshuva of the Ravid actually is going to be very similar to the Rava and Rav Zera story in the Gemara, yes. But why should I say it? Rabbi Hoffman, please.
So I'm going to refer to him as the Ravi, just to differentiate him from the Ravid, and also because, as we said, I'm very connected to that name. And so Rav Isidore Tversky writes about the Ravi that he composed every single form of rabbinic literature that was very popular at the time. So he wrote commentaries on the Gemara, of which we don't really have many anymore. He wrote a halachic code called the Sefer HaEshkol, and he also wrote responsa.
So he would have been doing like all these postmodern neo-Hasidic stuff today if he was living today, you're saying?
Yes, he'd be doing all that stuff. So he, all of his works, unfortunately, were eclipsed by others which were, in Rabbi Tversky's words, better than his. Oof. So the commentaries didn't really stand the test of time, and his code was really eclipsed by the Mishneh Torah, by the Torah Sabayis of the Rashba, by the Tor. And now we have some of his responsa, which were salvaged much later in life. They didn't play a big role through much of history. But the tshuva that we're going to be discussing today is actually quoted in the Tor. It's quoted in Choshen Mishpat Siman 425. And this area of the Shulchan Aruch, or of the Tor rather, is talking about extrajudicial, or what we might call extra halachic rabbinic authority, where the Torah has some prescribed punishments, some prescribed procedures of how we deal with criminal behavior. But sometimes there's a situation where the rabbi might feel that the way the Torah dealt with it wasn't enough to deal with the situation in front of them. They need to call upon their authority as a rabbi and give an additional consequence beyond what the Torah requires.
So, right. This is something that we see. Like if someone gets off, this comes up in Makos and Sanhedrin, someone gets off on a technicality, but clearly they're a serial killer. They're going to keep murdering more people. They can put him into a kippah, not to be confused with the yarmulke, and the guy can kind of be fed malnutritious food until they eventually die. When you think about it, it actually sounds worse than capital punishment. But right, yes. There is these kind of – it's funny the term extrajudicial, because these are given to Beis Din, but they're not – within the normal bounds of technicalities. These are forms of recourse when the technicalities don't work out and produce the result that's desired.
Yes, so it's actually interesting you make that point, because I had that exact thought, that the way that they describe this extrajudicial really a kind of an assassination of some kind, an execution. It really sounds quite horrible, and sometimes, arguably worse than the Arba Misos that's described in the Mishnah and the Gemara. So
or maybe it's like, you steal less than a shava pruta. It's like worse than stealing the pruta, because here you are, you're trying to circumvent the system. I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's similar reactions here. So anyway, so that's what he's dealing with. And how does that play into the issue of alcohol?
Yes. So he begins by quoting Gemara in Erevin 65a by saying that a drunk person, because we're dealing. So first of all, the question itself is probably the shortest shaila I've ever seen. It's only 11 words long. The shaila is, Ketov lev Moshe beyayin Purim, when the heart of Moshe was happy with wine on Purim. Obviously, that's paraphrasing the pasuk I just read about Achashverosh. Kam el achiv v'yahargehu, he rose up against his brother and killed him. Dino mahu, what is his din? How should we treat this person? Really a very short, very vague question. And as we read the tshuva, and this may be a bit interesting from a historical perspective, it seems that the Ravi did not really know the person he was talking about or the specific case that he was dealing with. There are some indications in here that he doesn't know so well the specifics other than were laid out to him in the question.
Right, so, and he even mentions that he makes reference to other rabbis who address the case b'tshuvosehem in their own tshuvo. So it sounds, and also in his conclusion, it sounds like he was not the only one who was asked, which I always find funny. I'll be talking with one colleague about a certain issue, and I'm like, oh, did that same person ask you that question also? So apparently he's not the only recipient of this shaila, but he does have quite a unique analysis. So let's break that down.
Yes, so he begins by discussing Gemara in Erevin 65a that says that a drunk person can engage in business and can even be chayav misa if they commit a capital offense. In other words, that's the way of saying that intoxication doesn't relieve responsibility. Even though a person does leave hold of their senses when they're drunk, they can still be responsible for what they do, both in business and in the legal circumstances as well. But Rabbi Chanina adds in on that Gemara and says that if they get as drunk as Lot, and as we know, the story of Lot in Bereishis, that Lot gets so drunk that his daughters end up sleeping with him, and that's how they father their two children. So really, if he gets as drunk as Lot, which is really beyond the pale, like passed out drunk, he's no longer conscious of anything, then the person is pater from everything. He can no longer be chayiv misa. He's no longer can no longer engage in business, and this person is truly not. Not required, is not obligated by what they do.
Well, which is interesting, because you can think, you can make the argument that true, once you are absolutely drunk and have no inhibition and no control, then we can't blame you. But can we hold you accountable for getting drunk in the first place, which was certainly a choice? I mean, Rahman al-Etzlan, when you hear about these terrible cases of a drunk driver killing people, but we could hold them accountable in law, because they should have known not to first get drunk and decide to get in a car. They should have made an arrangement ahead of time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one could argue that that's the majority opinion in the Gemara, and that Rabbi Chanina is presenting a very interesting, and we could even call a strange, minority opinion here.
Mm-hmm.
So definitely true. And in the drunk driver case, there are definitely modern poskim who say that such a person is a murderer bemezid, and not even a murderer beshogeg.
Oh, wow.
They get behind the wheel of a car when they're drunk. So lots of modern discussion on that as well, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
In our tshuva, the Ravi adds a line which I thought was very interesting. He writes about this person who is drunk. He says, "V'cheskas Purim, the assumption on Purim is that rov amei haaretz mishtakrim, is that the majority of amei haaretz, of people who really don't know halacha very well, they get drunk. So it seems to be that he's saying that yes, there's technically some requirement to get drunk. It's in the Gemara and Megillah, Dav Zayin Amud Beis. But we don't really paskin like that, and it's only the Amei Haaretz who take that at all seriously. Nevertheless, he brings this in as a way of saying, maybe there's a reason we should be leaning on this person. Perhaps he was as drunk as Lot, and therefore we don't have to punish him severely. It's not his fault.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing he says. Then he goes on to say that in any case, we don't really have witnesses that he did this murder. And we also don't know how to do the seven chakiros, the seven methods of examining the witnesses that they would have to do in a Beis Din, even though Beis Din isn't at all a factor in the 1100s anymore. It doesn't matter because the principles, the legal procedures that we had, we don't really know how to do them anymore. Therefore, maybe we shouldn't punish him for that reason. Now, this person did admit to the murder himself, so maybe we punish him by his own admission. However, he gives two principles here. It says, "Hapesha aser hu hapesha hitter," that the mouth that made him aser is the mouth that also exonerated him. And also, "Ein adam mesim atzmo rasha," a very interesting principle that a person cannot make themselves wicked. You know, that in American jurisprudence, a person can plead the fifth and say, "I would rather be quiet and not say any incriminating fact." But in Jewish law, if a person says an incriminating fact about themselves, we immediately dismiss it from court.
Right. So, when it comes to criminal matters, you know, where it's a result of malchus or capital punishment, for money, of course, you could be moda. And there's that whole, I think, kitsos and nesivos, the discussion is like an anuchiyev or it's a hoda. But I think this comes up in like, the shtika kahoda kind of discussions about admission. Rabbi Norman Lamb, I saw quoted in Tshuva from Rav Ariel, on Shtika Kahoda, Rabbi Lamb, I think this is in his Faith and Doubt volume. It's one of the essays in there where he distinguishes between the American jurisprudence and Jewish jurisprudence. In the American legal system, self-incrimination is a protection from self-incrimination, meaning one could willingly self-incriminate, but it's to protect you from the prosecutor tricking you into self-incriminating yourself. Hmm. Whereas in Judaism, even if I full well know what I am doing, I am incapable. It's not admissible in Beis Din for me to admit to committing a murder. So that's the issue we have here. That on the one hand, we kind of want to believe him, but technically we can't. So what can we do? And I know he brings an idea, it's going to move along a little bit, of Migdar Milsa, that maybe we need to kind of set a standard, because if we let this guy get off with killing someone while drunk, I mean, who knows where we're going to draw the line? I mean, it's going to become the purge, essentially, on Purim. And I believe there's discussion about, you know, little petty theft that's done on Purim. It's all fair game, according to some. So how do we make sure that Purim remains a holy holiday and not just the Jewish version of the purge?
Yes. So this is the point in the Megill, in the Tshuva, where he quotes the story of Rava and Rabbi Zeira, even though our Gemaras say Rabba and Rabbi Zeira. Rava and Rabbi Zeira, I believe, were colleagues, and Rava was the Talmud of Rabbi Zeira. So it really changes a lot of how you read the story. So that one gives a difference is very important. So Rava kills Rabbi Zeira due to Purim intoxication and then brings him back to life. So, and clearly he says there, we don't view Rava as a first-degree murderer. And just because this poor Moshe, this individual, does not have the ability to resurrect his friend from the dead, why should we view him as a first-degree murderer either? So he really lays out several reasons why one ought to be lenient. So
Rava does magically bring him back to life. So
yes,
he does reverse his act. I guess it's like almost like a Lav Hanite Klase, if you will, that he was able to make amends for that. But okay, be it as it may, we wouldn't consider it an act of murder, it sounds like.
Yes. So as we've seen, there are several reasons he presents to be lenient. First of all, he might have been as drunk as Lot and not responsible. We have no witnesses. We don't know how to do the seven chakiros. We've seen that a person cannot incriminate themselves by their own testimony. And as you pointed out, this is a capital offense. This is not a monetary offense. And there is a Radbaz on the Rambam who talks about why it will be different. It's because we own our money, therefore we can admit to a monetary loss, but we don't own our bodies, therefore we can't admit, we can't give up our own bodies, they don't belong to us. Also, the Ravi writes, this is not a repeat offense, and we would only put someone in the kippah and do that horrible death sentence if this was a repeat offense and something they do lahachis over and over again. And also, it seems that this person is also acting in self-defense, which is a very important detail here. Oh. It wasn't only a murder, he was actually protecting himself. This other person was hitting him first. And he says, if somebody comes to kill you, you can get up and kill them first. And all the more so, if someone's coming to hit you, you can hit them back. So how do we deal with this person? We have lots of reasons to be lenient. And here is where he turns and writes, "Ve'ata rabosai v'alufai, here my rabbis and my masters, al titnu yad l'poshim, don't give support to the sinners, lios kol ish tsorer k'mitz la'alea ha'yorazikin, that every person can be like a madman who's throwing these fire sticks, the yomer shogeg ha'yisi, and then can go and claim, I did this by accident." We can't give the support to people to make such an argument. So how should we punish the sinner? He gives three specific prescriptions that he recommends. First of all, we should punish him bodily. He murdered a person. He murdered a human being. He ripped a soul from a body. Therefore, he should be flogged morning and evening every day for a full 12 months, all the way until the victim's first yahrzeit. And he talks about the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah that all sinners get punished in Gehenna for 12 months. And also Rav in Brachos talks about that the dead are forgotten in some sense from the heart after 12 months. There's something about the period of 12 months that's important, that this is the time we need to make amends for the sin of murdering this person.
Right. And what's interesting, he says in that line, he's like, V'iyu katle kule, he completely killed him. Anan nakli pal gave him Malchus. We're just going to give him a half measure with Malchus.
Yes.
And then he says Malchus might be worse, possibly. But this is so fascinating. It's mirroring the Avelis practice that the belief theologically that informs the Avelis practice, rather, that the soul goes to Gehenna. Now, this is interesting because we assume someone who's like a Russia stays there for 12 months. So it sounds like we're just playing it safe over here. Maybe this guy initially attacked him. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe it was a Russia, which is interesting that he needs to do tshuva then if there was self-defense. That's a little bit unclear to me.
Yes. This is also coming at a time that sigufim or penances were very common, very widespread. There is an interesting trend in, you know, through the tshuvas, through the centuries, where sigufim and penances become less and less focused. There's a book by Rabbi Louis Jacobs, Theology in the Responsa, which goes through tshuvos from every single century up until the year 1975, from the Gaonim to 1975. And he does track a lot of the tshuvos about penances, and you can see it become less and less pronounced through time. In fact, not to get sidetracked, but there is an interesting tshuva by the Maharam in there where Maharam does not allow someone to do penances for committing murder, even though the murderer wanted to. Right, people wanted to do penances because they felt like they cleansed their soul. It really felt good for them. They felt they were doing something. They were healing themselves in some way. And in the Middle Ages, especially the early Middle Ages, this was very focused on. Sefer Chassidim has a bunch of this.
Of course,
that if a person committed adultery, for example, they should in the summer sit in hot sand and get stung by bees, or in the winter sit in the cold snow, and they should stay there for the amount of time that they committed the sin. Well, so there's a lot of emphasis on this, of these sigufim, and it becomes less and less focused on as we go forward.
So this isn't, for the historical context, this isn't some exotic recommendation that's being given here. This is all within the fair bounds of sigufim in general. So I see what you're saying. And so he recommends two other methods also, right?
Yes, and two other things he suggests is that if this victim, if the murdered person had any relatives who are children, then the murderer should support them for the duration until these minors grow up. And the third thing he recommends is that this murderer should shave his head and beard as a sign of mourning, the same way that Eov did, which seems to run into Isurim, actually, which is kind of interesting, right? Because you're not allowed to cut 5 peos of your beard, of your head, but he recommends that this person shave his head and beard. So he must have had reasons for it, but they are beyond me. And he does not explain them or even point to the fact that this might be halachically problematic in the tshuva itself.
Well, now we know why the sefer didn't get codified in the end, right?
Must have been.
Does he say something at the end about, I may have misread it, sensitivity to this individual's children, that they shouldn't be?
Yes, so that's coming up. So before we get to that, he also adds that in addition to these three, if the individual wants to do more sigufim, if he wants to engage in fasts and other kinds of punishments for himself, if he wants to eliminate pleasant things from his life, like he doesn't want to eat meat, for example, this is me adding conjecture, like for if he doesn't want to eat meat, or maybe he wants to wear rough clothing or things like, these are the kinds of sigufim that would have happened elsewhere in the Middle Ages, right? that if he wanted to do that to appease heaven, he says, these are his words, he says, all the better for this person. And he writes to the rabbis who asked him the question, you will know if he's capable of such things, and you can recommend and even force him to do these things
right.
as
This
well.
This is the original, consult your local Orthodox rabbi.
Yes, exactly. So this is one of the indications, again, as I said before, he doesn't really know this person personally. He doesn't know the murderer. He doesn't know the murdered. And he's just asked his opinion on this general case in front of him. So he also writes that we should publicize all of these things to the people. We shouldn't do this in private. They should know what's going on. And he writes that if he accepts all these conditions, then anyone who calls him a murderer should be put in all sorts of cherem and nidui and shamta for at least a 30-day period. But if the community feels it appropriate, they can release the person from the cherem immediately. The cherem is like a form of excommunication where the person is, you're not allowed to conduct business with them, you're not allowed to talk to them, can't count them for a minion, and so on. So no one is allowed to call him a murderer. He is a genuine penitent, meaning he's now doing tshuva and he's recovering from his sin. And he also writes that you certainly shouldn't embarrass his wife or children because of this. And he ends the tshuva by saying that if the circumstances require that you add more punishments on what I said, or you subtract from the punishments that I've suggested, then please do so. Another indication that he didn't know the exact people involved in this case.
Right. So as we're, this is a great summary of the tshuva. And as we're, you know, we have a few minutes left. So he mentions about the children at the end as well, and kind of sensitivity to the family, if I understood correctly. And what would you say also are the broader takeaways from his tshuva? This is being written in the medieval era, which I know is your area of expertise. But I have a feeling that there was some broader takeaway that you may have wanted to share with our listeners.
Yes. So although a few minutes ago I did describe these penances, these sigufim, as being more widespread in the Middle Ages, one shouldn't think that there was a person doing sigufim in every single minyan, in every single block, in every single community. These were somewhat rare. And you did have to do something pretty terrible in the Middle Ages to warrant these kinds of sigufim. So it does give you a sense of how valuable human life is, because we did list at the beginning all the reasons why we can be lenient on this person. It wasn't his fault. It was in self-defense. He was drunk. It was Purim. You know, all these things. Why in the world is he being treated so harshly? At the end of the day, you killed a human being. Even though you killed someone who may have attacked you, even though you may have been drunk on Purim and you have a right to be drunk on Purim, maybe even a mitzvah to be drunk on Purim, nevertheless, we have to treat you as harshly as possible because you killed a person. That is the value of a human life. And I think for the modern day, it really does shed a lot of light on an issue that we touched on briefly, which is people who get drunk on Purim and then go driving, or do drunk driving any day of the year, where when we're dealing with a case of sakanas nefashos, where people are treating other human lives as that disposable, it's really a very deep spiritual and moral stain, not just on them, but on the entire society. And it's something that we need to be thinking a lot more carefully about. You know, the Ravi here does talk about drinking on Purim as something that only the Amei Haaretz do. And in some sense, it reflects later poskim who write that the most appropriate method of drinking on Purim is to drink a little bit and then to fall asleep, as the Mishnah Berura writes, as other write, as the Rama writes. And the people who treat it that casually really need to do deep cheshbon hanefesh in the way that they're treating a somewhat minor mitzvah on Purim, which may not even be a mitzvah according to some poskim, and they're treating it that strictly in relation to something as valuable as human life. It's a very, very deep and important thing to think about.
100%. The importance of sanctity of life. And also, I think, I forget, maybe you'll remember for me, there are some interpretations that the whole Rav Razir story in the Gemara comes after that mandate to get inebriated, to repudiate that, and to tell us that, Dafka, you shouldn't be getting drunk to the point that you're going to commit an act of violence or murder.
Yes. There are definitely halachic positions that mention that, and like you, I'm forgetting the specific details, but I've definitely seen that in halachos as well.
Very good. So I think this is a very important point, which is kind of weighing the importance of the drinking and the inebriation. I mean, I always I always get upset whenever I see people. So at Kiddush, you know, they just like take an expensive scotch and they down it. And clearly their intent is for the totsa of getting drunk. And meanwhile, I'm like, you know, like this was like an 18-year Lagavulin and you're just like drinking. Like, I mean, honestly, if they know what they're doing and they're drinking Lagavulin, they're going to burn their throats up because that's of the smokier variety. I try to enjoy for the flavor, honestly. But right. It's a culture that you see in many communities. It's culture. I think you said that that the Amaratsim were doing back in the day. But I think the challenging thing is seeing people who we don't even consider the Hamon Am, people who we consider to be major Torah scholars, and then degrading themselves by getting drunk to that point and doing things that you wouldn't expect from someone of that stature. And certainly to the extent where you're risking other Averos Chamuros. And yes, you really have to do a real cost-benefit analysis and ask, is this the responsible thing for me to be doing? So I think that's a very important lesson going in for Purim. And Rabbi Hoffman,
you just mentioned a whole other, which we didn't get to touch on, which is the mitzvos that one has to keep, davening, making brachos with the proper kavana, and all the.
Why do we forget about those?
If one would, we didn't have time to get into those before, because this is the most important issue here. We're talking about human life, but that is a whole other area of halacha on Purim to make sure that one can do the mitzvos that they have to do. If one will not daven mincha with the proper kavana because they're too drunk, then really, then scharo yotze behefsedo, in a certain sense. And one more thing I'll throw out is that in the time of the Ravi and in the time of the Rishonim and even most Achronim, they did not have cars or heavy machinery. You know, if someone were to get drunk or too drunk on Purim, the only danger would be to the person's own liver or to the people within literal striking distance. Today, it's much different. And today, it's much, much more unsafe. And Hatzalah routinely puts out campaigns. For example, one called "Don't Get Carried Away This Purim." And there it's a pun because they mean that both figuratively and literally, that people get carried away on Purim, and the hospitals and the emergency rooms in communities which are very, very religious, unfortunately, are more full on Purim than any other day of the year. It leads to massive Chilulei Hashem. And it's, you know, this kind of tshuva, I think, really gives us a perspective on how important it is to not get carried away by drinking on Purim and really what's at stake.
Right. Well, God willing, we should only hear Besoros Tovos this Purim. And Rabbi Hoffman, thank you so much for both the Torah Umada, all the wonderful historical analysis that you provided for this tshuva as well. I always say it's important that when we do tshuvas on the podcast, that, you know, if someone could read Hebrew and they read the tshuva, they should be able to get more from the podcast out of it than just how they read it themselves. So you certainly provided that. And God willing, looking forward to all the other amazing things you'll be continuing to do teaching Klal Yisrael. Hashem should give you continued hatzlacha, and wishing you and our listeners a Freilich and Purim.
Thank you, a Freilich and Purim, and a safe and Freilich and Purim.
Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.